9 paralyzed polio patients with Kendall more than 4. There was no significant overuse of remaining motor units. And the EMG quotient, that's the quotient between the integrated EMG during walking and the EMG during maximal voluntary contraction, was less than 2 times the normal one. These patients had 53 to 100% type 1 fibers with a median of 82%. In the second group was 8 patients which had a combination of a paralysis with Kendall 3 to 4 and a marked overuse of remaining motor units. The EMG quotient was 2 to 4 times the normal one, and these patients had 93 to 100% type 1 fibers, and the median type 1 fiber percentage was 100% in this group. I should add that most of these patients estimated that they were as active as normal subjects. In the last group, the last 4 patients were severely paralyzed with Kendall less than 3. And the remaining muscle tissue was not used during walking. 3 were wheelchair bound, and 1 walked with braces without using the residual anterior tibial muscle motor units. And these patients had 10 to 69% type 1 fibers with a median of 29%. On the basis of these last patients who were severely affected by polio and have had a low percentage of type 1 fibers, one can conclude that the percentage of type 1 fibers is not due to the severity of polio. Type 2 muscle fibers are innervated by motor neurons with high threshold and high axonal conduction velocity. The axonal conduction velocity was measured in the polio patients in this study directly in the motor units to the extensor digitorum brevis muscle and by means of F-wave latencies in the motor units of the anterior tibial muscle, and did not differ from normal values. Thus, there was no signs of a reduced proportion of high threshold and high conduction velocity motor units in our patients. And our conclusion is that polio subjects who walked in a normal way by using all remaining motor units in the anterior tibial muscle in each stride had a transition of type 2 muscle fibers to type 1 fibers. And we are now planning to a follow-up of this group of polio patients and a group of patients, less mobile patients with differentiated muscles, to elucidate if long-term use might be harmful for the remaining motor units.
We're now open for questions.
Dalakas, NIH, the first slide that you showed on the two muscle fibers that you compared, there was significant grouping of type 1 fibers. When you re-biopsy, you found only type 1s. We know that needle biopsy is notoriously unreliable to count grouping. It's just a small specimen, so I suspect that this, if you have done an open biopsy, you have gotten a bigger piece, you could have seen other, that this may not have been the case. And that's one comment. And the second is, I'm not aware of that type 2 neurons have higher threshold and they conduct faster. I don't think we know that. Or the type 2 fibers are innervated by type 2 neurons. We don't really know that. It's an assumption.
Well, I could give you an answer of the first question. Well, it was in the material of 21 biopsies. We had 9 biopsies with 100% or around 100% type 1 fibers. and these were sufficient in size to judge that it was not type grouping. That it was type grouping, but we didn't have any type 2 muscle fibers in the muscle.
Lennart Grimbeck, and I answer the second question. We definitely know that the type 2 muscle fibers are innervated by high threshold, rapidly conducting motor neurons from animal experiments and from several human experiments.
It was a very nice presentation. Jasper Dalby, Mayo Clinic, and raises a lot of interesting hypotheses. I'd like to ask a question about your placement of the wire electrodes for identifying the motor units. Was this a random placement, or did you manipulate it to get it near one or another unit? And did you record from more than one site in the muscle? Because which units you're looking at may be fairly critical.
I could pass on that question to
Lennart Grimby. The wire electrode is inserted into a large, we look for a large cluster of muscle fibers innervated by one and the same motor neuron. And in prior poliomyelitis, it is not very difficult to find such large clusters. And when we have a cluster sufficiently large to record just one motor unit during maximal contraction or supramaximal electrical nerve stimulation, then we leave the electrode there, and if we are lucky, the recording remains during walking for a considerable period of time. It is definitely not at random. We must look for the cluster, and then we can define different types of clusters, clusters belonging to low threshold motor neurons and clusters belonging to high threshold motor neurons, and we can study the axonal conduction velocities of these motor neurons, and thus identify the type of motor neuron.
Thank you very much. Oh, we have one more question.
Peter Cow, I was just going to ask whether you looked at the uninvolved as well as the involved muscle to see if there's differences in fiber types between involved and uninvolved muscle.
Well, this is a preliminary study, and we haven't looked at different sites in different muscles yet.
Our next speaker is one of our moderators, Dr. Weekers, who will talk on reinnervation after acute polio. I think this may be one of my patients. Is it?
No.
Oh.
Have significant acute polio in the United States. However, we do have isolated cases of vaccine-associated polio. These are individuals who, for some unknown reason, seem to develop polio after receiving oral polio-saving vaccine. Many times these individuals actually shed virus and then either reactivate the virus in a contact, usually a parent who's changing the diapers or something, who may or may not have been adequately immunized against polio, comes in contact with a reactivated form of the virus and obtains acute disease. I have just jotted down the data from the CDC. It's also of note that in 1982 and 1983 there were 21 reported cases, 9 from 82 and 12 from 83. 8 of these were also in recipients of oral trivalent vaccine. And normally the recipient gets it in the first dose. I don't think there's ever been an episode where they get it in the second or third. There have been cases. I'm getting a nodding up here. Okay. In the 21 cases in 82 and 83, 9 were in contacts, and 3 were in immune-deficient individuals. Unfortunately, many times a person is immune-deficient and doesn't know it until they get their first trivalent oral polio vaccine. What I'm going to discuss this morning is a case of a child who I've been following for the past 2 years, who is a recipient of polio by the oral vaccine. I have another case of an older individual who we'll discuss in another time. But this child, at the age of 2 months, first received the vaccine on the 2nd of July of 1984, and then about 23 days later had acute viral meningitis. Over the next several days, his fever subsided, but the mother noted that he was not moving his lower legs. 2 days later, he started moving the right leg, but there was still no movement in the left. 2 days later, I saw the patient, and at this time, there was only function in the right and left ankle dorsiflexors and in the plantar flexors and knee flexors and toe flexors, and this was just very minimal movement. If we look just here in the third column, what we're looking at is when the patient's strength returned to at least anti-gravity level. And you can see that by 1 month, those muscles that just had minimal movement were now of anti-gravity strength. And the hip flexor returned very quickly. 2 months after polio, the right hip extensor, and then 4 months, the left hip adductor, the left knee extensor. Very little occurred between 4 and 9 months post-polio when the left hip extensor came and then the right knee extensor. And then at 14 months, he regained the right hip flexor and the left hip abductor. There still is no function in the left hip abductor or the right hip adductor. The next slide, just looking at this column, tells you when we got greater than anti-gravity strength. This is just the previous slide expanded. So that this child has showed a very slow, steady, continuous return of muscle strength over the past 14 months post-polio. Now, if we look at his functional activity, at 6 months post-polio at 9 months of age, he could sit if you sat him up, but he could not get into the sitting position independently. By 9 months, he was crawling but dragging the right leg because there was very little active right hip flexor function. 12 months post-polio, 1 year, he was sitting independently. X-rays at this time were taken to look at his hips to be sure that they were okay. And what we found was that his pelvis was somewhat tilted higher on the left side, and he had what appeared to be a long curve in the thoracic lumbar area to the right, implying that there may be some paraspinal musculature involvement. By 13 months, he was trying to pull to standing, but would only get to his knees, and then would kind of walk along the furniture on his knees. It was at this time that we felt it was time to brace this child. Then by 16 months post-polio, or 19 months of age, he was pulling to standing, and he was walking with bilateral ankle-foot orthoses in the parallel bars. We had placed a half-inch heel and sole lift on the left side to compensate for this apparent leg-left discrepancy, even though it was actually a tilt of the pelvis. By 18 months, he was walking with a wheeled walker. By 20 months post-polio, standing balance had returned. We reduced the size of the shoe lift to 1 centimeter. By 21 months, he was finally walking without his walker, and by 27 months post-polio, he was climbing stairs and descending with a rail, and he actually was now without the long leg braces, using only a left ankle-foot orthosis, which he really preferred not to wear, and had a foot drop on the left side of with a 1 centimeter shoe lift. Of interest, here is Zach. And you can see that he has this apparent leg length shortening on the left in spite of the fact that x-rays show the legs to be of equal length. You can kind of get the impression of the tilt of the pelvis. Here he is turned sideways, and you can get a kind of an impression of the slight curve to his spine. Now when he stands and tries to hold himself straight, he's able to demonstrate fairly good posture. Now his right knee extensor became of anti-gravity strength 9 months after polio. By 12 months, it was stronger than anti-gravity. The EMG at 21 months after polio showed the following. When I first examined him electrically 1 month after the onset of disease, there was absolutely no voluntary activity at all in this muscle, just profound positive sharp waves and fibrillation potentials. By 21 months post-polio, or 2 years of age, he's had a significant number of active motor units, but still an overall marked decrease in number compared to normal. He was of greater than anti-gravity strength. The amplitude of these motor units recorded with a monopolar electrode at a frequency response of 20 hertz to 10 kilohertz was still within the normal range. His duration was still normal, but the polyphasic potentials were very frequent, very common, and surprisingly, all of the motor units were unstable with repetitive discharge at 2 years of age and 21 months post-polio. This is actually, a lot of the units were longer, had late components and were longer than normal, but the overall mean was still within the normal range. If we look at the left knee extensor, it became anti-gravity in strength 4 months after polio, and by 9 months was quite strong. Electrically, there were only two motor units functioning in this muscle at 1 month post-polio. By 21 months, almost 2 years post-polio, he had a marked decrease in number, in spite of the fact that it was greater than anti-gravity strength. His amplitudes were slightly lower than they were on the opposite side. His durations were longer. Every motor unit was very polyphasic and abnormal in shape, and every motor unit was unstable with repetitive discharge. The right ankle dorsiflexor became anti-gravity strength 1 month after polio. By 2 months, it was stronger than anti-gravity strength, so this muscle came back very quickly. EMG showed quite a few motor units, a moderate decrease. The normal moderate loss, marked loss, or no function. Moderate had quite a few number. It was of anti-gravity strength when first examined 1 month after polio. All the motor units were of very normal size. By essentially 2 years post-polio, or 21 months, he really had not regained enough motor units to say that there was only a mild loss. It was still a moderate loss of motor units, even though he was now greater than anti-gravity strength. The amplitudes were approaching the upper limit of normal. The durations, he had some units that were excessively long in duration, but overall the means averaged out to remain at the upper limit of normal. Almost all motor units, again, were polyphasic, and they were almost all unstable with repetitive discharge. Here's recordings to show the great variability in the shape of the motor unit potential with repetitive discharge. In other words, here with monopolar electrodes, we're seeing what is the equivalent on single fiber EMG of a lot of increased jitter and blocking. In other words, there are transmission abnormalities occurring within this motor unit. Now, another motor unit, again showing you the great variability in shape and size, the overall duration of this motor unit, each of these segments being 1 millisecond in duration, is really not all that long. We had many recordings as this one, whereby it looked exactly like a single fiber recording, where the late component, if you will, or this variable component that was appearing at variable positions with repetitive discharge of the motor unit looked just like a single fiber recording, even though this was performed with a monopolar electrode. And you can see when the straight line goes through the place of appearance, as it does in about four superimposed of the 10 discharges here, that this second potential did not appear in time and was actually blocking, or there was failure of transmission to these fibers. We see the same thing here in a non-superimposed sweep, where this motor unit shows failure of transmission to this component of this reinnervating motor unit, now essentially 2 years post-polio. And here another example of the same phenomenon, where there is obviously great variability of neuromuscular transmission and failure of transmission. This is to show you the extreme variability of motor unit shape and size This was recorded from the left rectus femoris, where there were very many areas where there was only one motor unit functioning. And this was the only motor unit functioning in a wide area in this muscle. And I don't have the proper tracing to show you, but this same complex appeared at a later time, implying that there was indeed some neurogenic blocking, as Dr. Saunders discussed. So what we're seeing here is the effects of reinnervation by terminal axon sprouting, where we lose an anterior horn cell due to polio in this case, and its muscle fibers are orphaned, and then terminal axon sprouts go out and reconnect to some of these orphaned fibers. Now, as Dr. Saunders pointed out, in the facial nerve injury, he had stabilization of those motor units, or complete recovery as far as transmission abnormalities within 3 months. Dr. Stahlberg and the plastic surgeons at Uppsala have demonstrated where they transplant muscle from one side of the body to the other in the face after Bell's palsy, that the motor units themselves become stable and transmission abnormalities are gone in 4 to 6 months. In our work that's been previously reported about stabilization of motor units following peripheral nerve injuries or radiculopathies, they are normally stable by 6 to 12 months. So to find this instability of motor units occurring now almost 2 years post-polio is somewhat surprising, or at least it was to me. I had anticipated that these motor units would stabilize in their transmission over a period of about 6 months to a year, but to our surprise, reinnervation is still going on at 21 months post-polio, which brings up several questions. If indeed these abnormalities that we're seeing electrically are due to terminal axon sprouting, it may continue for many more years than we originally thought. This could be a factor that the muscles that we're looking at in this child are situations where there are many, many more deinnervated muscle fibers than will ever be reinnervated. This child will never be able to reinnervate all of the muscle fibers in this muscle with the few surviving axons or motor units that he has. So here's a situation where the motor unit may continue over a long period of time to recapture deinnervated muscle fibers. Also, this child is obviously growing and developing, and so that may have a factor here. Now, this motor unit may never stabilize, but I have a feeling that it will. It may take on many more muscle fibers than it could service. It's quite possible that the motor unit may never stabilize and will just keep on taking on more muscle fibers than it can service and will never have really good transmission capabilities in a muscle where there are more muscle fibers that are deinnervated than will ever be reinnervated. This is a possibility. The muscle or the motor units that survive may try to take on too many muscle fibers, and we may have a constant ongoing process of regaining and losing and regaining and losing. And that may be a possibility that could occur in this situation if the motor units never stabilize. So in concluding, I think that the real issue here is, does the motor unit stabilize after acute polio? My feeling is, from our initial studies in 1981, that it does stabilize, and that stabilization then lasts for about 25 to 30 years, after which time we start to see a loss of that stability or a loss of that transmission. But it will only be with following these acute polio patients who are vaccine associated or who possibly in Taiwan or wherever we can find these people to see whether or not motor unit stabilization does indeed occur. From our studies in people who have had polio 20 years ago, 18 years ago, it does appear to occur. I would encourage you to send to me or to look carefully yourselves at those patients who are vaccine associated or those acute cases of polio to see if indeed the motor units are stabilizing. Possibly we will find that it's variable, where there are muscles where the motor units only have a few muscle fibers to reinnervate, they'll stabilize very quickly. In others where there are many, many more muscle fibers than can be reinnervated, it will take us time to find out whether or not they ever do stabilize. Certainly, the motor neuron may have some plasticity, and many of these factors can be involved. Thank you.
Can I ask the first question? Doctor, did you do stimulation at 1 month to see whether a lot of these neurons were neuropraxic or not? Because it sounds to me like your second EMG indicated they were or not.
The question is, were many of these nerves neuropraxic? Obviously some were, because there was no function in the muscle before. And now there were some, so there was obviously some spinal shock from the acute inflammation or something occurring at 1 month.
Feldman from Edmonton. This brings up an interesting situation. Many years ago when I was a student, we came across a patient who was thought at that time to have Landry's ascending polio that obviously had Guillain-Barré syndrome. And I'm really wondering whether what we're looking at here is not just post-polio, but perhaps down the line other disease entities such as GBS or maybe peripheral nerve injuries that are going to react the same way after reinnervation. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, you or the other presenters today.
Is the late effects of polio only heralding us on to look at the late effects of Guillain-Barré and other disorders? And I feel that they probably will.
I'd like to rephrase Ernie Johnson's questions. Did you do motor conduction studies, and what were the evoked response amplitudes at the two times? And secondly, what extent of fibrillation potentials were present at these re-examinations when you had the varying units?
Two excellent questions. Motor nerve conduction studies were done initially. They were 32 meters per second in the peroneal nerve bilaterally with an amplitude of 800 microvolts. They haven't been done this time as of yet at the two-year period. I'm grooming this family into a long history of repetitive electrical studies, and we're doing them very carefully and very slowly over a long period of time. So I don't have data today as to what the amplitudes of the peroneal nerve conductions would be, or the compound muscle action potential, but hopefully in a couple months I will.
Fibrillation?
Fibrillation potentials. Fibrillation potentials were quite profound, obviously, at the first 1 month. At 21 months post-polio, it was very difficult to get the child relaxed enough to look at a normal baseline potential. So I can't say that quantitatively there was exactly the same amount. However, between bursts of voluntary activity, there did not appear to be the profuse nature of fibrillation potentials in positive ways as I had seen before. As a matter of fact, I felt that at 2 years, they were no longer quite profound. There were areas where there were a lot of fibrillations, but it was not the profound fibrillation in positive waves that I saw initially at 4 weeks.
McComas, McMaster, this is obviously a very special study and very elegantly presented. I noticed that in some of the traces, the initial spike resembled later components in its amplitude and configuration.
Can you turn it on? I can go back.
Yes. If you look at the third trace, the third spike looks very much like, well, in fact, the second and third look very much like a later one. That's it, yes, that one there. And can you see another figure?
Yes.
Another slide? Well, God. I'm sorry, you've lost me now. But anyway, I was rather impressed by this on several of the traces, and I had wondered whether, in fact, there was some iterative firing going on, perhaps due to nerve twigs with low thresholds for excitation and responding to electrical currents flowing in groups of fibers. Presumably you could sort this out by just moving the needle a little bit and seeing whether the spikes changed together or whether they dissociated.
That's an excellent point, and there's no reason to believe that that isn't also occurring. I really did not look at that. I have this on tape. I can go back and evaluate that. Do you think that would have some significance as far as this overall process? Are you thinking of, can you help me? What are you thinking of here as what this would mean or how this would be helpful?
Well, I think it's probably a sign of immaturity of some of the new twigs which have formed, inasmuch that for some reason or another they have a much lower threshold to excitation, perhaps partly to do with their myelination. One must also take into account that the fibers are now forming in groups, and every time a motor unit discharges, there's going to be a much bigger field current flowing around the nerve twigs, which could well produce this. In animal muscles, the phenomenon of backfiring is well recognized, although even to date, the mechanism hasn't been finally established.
The time factor on these recordings, you can see it's a 1 millisecond per division, so these would be very, very quick.
Robin Bielek, CDC. I thought it would be valuable to give you some epidemiologic perspective on the incidence of vaccine-associated cases. For those who are not aware, wild virus has not circulated in the United States probably since 1979, so that all non-imported cases of new acute polio in the United States now are vaccine-associated. Unpublished data at CDC show that that in both immunologically normal and abnormal persons combined, there is the incidence is now approximately one case of vaccine-associated polio per 3 million doses of vaccine distributed. But this is divided between first dose and subsequent dose, and the incidence for first dose is more like one case per million doses distributed, and subsequent dose one per 100 million doses distributed. So it is a first dose phenomenon, but second dose vaccine-associated cases are not unknown. They're just very rare. We've been discussing the possibility of collecting together a large number of these vaccine-associated cases from recent years, about which for whom we have extensive data. And Dr. Weekers is discussing the possibility of a prospective study of a large cohort of these cases through an extended period. He says he's going to live another 30 years and study those cases during the entire period.
David, just one question. Did you see fasciculations, and something else I want to ask you?
Fasciculations in a 21-month-old child are very, very difficult to see. That's my only comment.
We have, it's so important to look at patients with early polio, both electrophysiologically and analyzing the spinal fluid. And doing that, we have contacted the people in Taiwan. There is an electrophysiologist there who has done for his patients some early electrophysiological studies 4 or 5 years after polio, because there was in Taiwan a recent outbreak of polio. And he has reported to us that he has found fibrillations and instability of motor units up to 5 years that he has studied so far. However, there is variability from patient to patient and from muscle to muscle, even the same patients, according to the reports that he has sent us.
Well, I think that statement is very crucial, and we know that the polio patients tell us that they didn't reach their maximum point of recovery, many of them, for 7 or 8 years. So it's quite possible that this reinnervation process, which when we think of peripheral nerve injury or muscle transplant type things, that normally only goes on for less than a year, may go on for many, many years, and would help to explain why the polio patient states that they really didn't reach their maximum point of recovery for 7 or 8 years following polio.
Thank you.
I'm going to have an elegant summary discussant
and philosophic view of the morning session by Dr. Jasper Dalby.
Ernie, I'm afraid I'm going to have to beg off on the philosophy. But I do want to thank all four of the speakers this morning for presenting to us some remarkable techniques and showing us the kinds of information that they can give us. Information that they've made clear has not been yet fully obtained on the patients with the post-polio syndrome. I think this is particularly important for those of you associated with funding organizations out there, that there is still a great deal to be done, and there are new kinds of techniques that can be applied to help to answer what's going on in the patients with the post-polio syndrome. Clearly, the techniques that were talked about here this morning in the last few talks focus on the peripheral neuromuscular apparatus, and that, of course, is the area that I'm familiar with and all that I'm going to say anything about. Before commenting on the talks, there have been a number of comments here from those of you who don't know an F-wave from a sensory nerve action potential, and I thought I'd make a few comments for that group, which I think probably makes up the majority of you, on some of the general terms that have been used. The amplitude of the compound muscle action potential, just the size of the response that we can evoke, really reflects the amount of muscle tissue that's there. It does vary somewhat with fiber size, but more with the number of muscle fibers, and can be used as a very simple method for defining how much muscle is there in the patients, and can be used, as we and others have used it quite effectively, in looking at quantitatively what's happening over time. The area of the compound muscle action potential is a little more accurate in defining that, but requires more complicated methods to identify it. Terms like latency and conduction velocity simply are talking about how fast the nerve is working, and is really of relatively less significance for the post-polio patients unless they've developed a superimposed disease, which we need to remember. As many of you have heard, patients may develop a peripheral neuropathy, carpal tunnel syndrome, ulnar neuropathy, a radiculopathy. Many of those can be identified by standard nerve conduction studies, and in particular, sensory conduction studies. The motor conduction studies may show a little bit of change. There may be a little slowing of conduction just on the basis of loss of anterior horn cells, particularly as Ernie Johnson showed many years ago, if those legs are cool. It's hard to keep some patients who have atrophic legs warm. So that the conduction velocity and motor conduction has to be interpreted with caution. F-wave latencies look at the response going all the way back up to the spinal cord and back out to the muscle, so do give us then an estimate of proximal function in the same way that conduction velocities give us peripheral estimates of function. Repetitive stimulation can be done, as Dr. McComas has shown very nicely, with rapid or slow rates of stimulation. The slow rates are used to identify primarily defects of the neuromuscular junction, but I think what we need to keep in mind is that any neuromuscular junction that's being reinnervated by new axons will show changes that look just like those in a patient with a primary disease, that is myasthenia gravis. So changes in amplitude may be on the basis of reinnervation, and this, along with a number of the other things we're going to mention, can tell us that there's ongoing reinnervation. The rapid rates of stimulation haven't been given enough attention, primarily because it's a lot harder to get patients to cooperate and to be willing to come back after you give the rapid rates. Only certain 52-year-old investigators are willing to let them do it on themselves. But they can be significant because they can tell something about the function of peripheral nerve and the function of peripheral nerve axons to carry rapid stimuli, the rate of firing being often the functional impairment that we may be seeing in a patient who gets fatigued. If they're pushing the axons too hard in their new axons, they may stop functioning. So it's a technique that ought to be considered, as Dr. McComas has nicely shown. The needle examination, when we talk about fibrillation potentials, these are very specific, easily identified potentials that tell us that there's a muscle fiber there that's not innervated. And usually we think of that as meaning some kind of neurogenic disease, but I think I need to remind the group, this is familiar to the electromyographers, that fibrillation potentials also occur in many myopathies. If there's a regenerating muscle fiber, before that muscle fiber is innervated, it will fibrillate. If there's a muscle fiber that's been split, it will fibrillate. If there's longitudinal segmental necrosis along the muscle fiber with isolation from its innervation, it'll fibrillate. So fibrillation potentials simply tell us that there's something that's not innervated. They don't tell us what the mechanism is for that. But it's important because it tells us that there are non-innervated fibers. Fasciculation potentials, in contrast, I think we should probably ignore. I think we should ignore them because they're present in all of us, and they vary in all of us over time. the extent to which you find them depends on how much vigor you use looking for them. They're single spontaneous discharges that simply tell you that there's a motor unit there that's irritable. That irritability is clearly greater in some diseases. It's greater, for example, in ALS. It's also greater in patients who have radiculopathies and a variety of other phenomena. But they're so hard to measure quantitatively, and they're so common in normal as well as abnormal muscles, that I don't think that we can use them for any kind of diagnostic or separation purposes. They are also easy to mix up with the potentials that occur just from large motor units in patients who can't relax, and therefore I just don't have much faith in them. Many of the kinds of things that can be assessed from motor unit potentials can be very important, and the elegant review by Dr. Sanders of the variety of measures, not only the old, more common measures of amplitude and duration, but measurements of fiber density, measurements of jitter, measurements of turns, and the macro EMG technique, which is not very widely applied and has some major potential applications in assessing what's going on in post-polio, are all of major importance. And they can help to distinguish the loss of motor units from the so-called fractionation of motor units, or the selective loss of individual axons, or the loss of muscle fibers from the unit. The variability of motor units that David talked about so nicely is similar to decremented means. There's ongoing re-innervation and can give us evidence that there's something that's still evolving in these patients. Autonomic testing, which is what I guess Dr. Shahani was going to talk about, I can't say anything about other than we can test it electrically. It's the same thing we do with lie detector testing. And it may well be, maybe someone here knows what he's going to say, that some of the newer techniques that are simple to apply of electrical stimulation and recording the electrical skin potential may show some changes in post-polio patients. We've been using it in ordinary peripheral neuropathies with small fiber disorders, but have not looked in the post-polio patients. Does anyone know how he's been applying that?
He stated that in doing those stimulation studies as well as looking at RR intervals, they were normal in the post-polio patients.
Dr. Bork's presentation was another one that I found quite exciting, showing, I think, fairly convincingly, at least for a preliminary report, that there can be changes in motor units, and it raises the question, when a motor unit becomes type 1 and all you have is type 1s, clearly patients who have only type 1 units are going to make some type 2 efforts, but we all have motor units there for when we need that big effort. What's that going to do to a type 1 unit? May it produce damage to the individual fibers, damage to the axons within the muscle fiber, or some other processes? And I think it's an exciting addition to the kind of information we have. And then finally, of course, what David has shown us is the evolution and our need for knowing what happens in the evolution. I guess my judgment would be that these motor units, that is, in a severely involved muscle, will never stabilize, that there will be ongoing variability, ongoing remodeling of the unit. I say that primarily because if you look at, remember, in most peripheral nerve lesions, you've got all the axons there, or most of them can come out and reinnervate. The polio patient may only have 3 or 5 or 10 axons, and so you're really stressing the muscle and expecting it to be reinnervated in a way that's different from peripheral nerve. In proximal peripheral nerve lesions, in proximal plexus lesions and root lesions that are severe, long afterwards, without evidence of ongoing disease, you'll see the same things, that is, varying motor units and persistent fibrillation potentials that I believe remain present indefinitely, and I think are also present in the post-polio patients, and is what we have to differentiate when we're trying to decide, is the progression related to this ongoing activity, or is it just what's been there all the time? Thank you very much.
A wonderful synopsis. We're ready for lunch. We're going to eat in the Georgia Hall dining room where we ate last night. Remember, 1:10, the picture. Pick up your ties.
This is the end of tape 8 and concludes this portion of the program.